This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. On Monday, four former presidents, Barack Obama, George Bush, Bill Clinton, and Jimmy Carter, all tipped their hats in honor of the 100-year anniversary of baseball's Negro Leagues. Here's Obama, just because I miss hearing his voice.
I'm tipping my hat to everybody in the Negro Leagues who left a century-long legacy of talent and spirit and dignity on our country. So here's to Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, Cool Papa Bell, and everybody else.
We're going to start this week's show with a story about Satchel Paige, the greatest Negro Leagues pitcher of all time.
His catchers actually had to cushion their gloves with a beefsteak.
A religious cult that brought thousands of people to the American Midwest.
They had an empire. They really had like a Roman empire in Michigan.
And a mystery that took 4.5 decades to solve. Phil Lease can't remember exactly when he first learned about the game his father caught for Satchel Paige. It was the 60s, and Phil was a kid living in Hamilton Dome, Wyoming.
Smaller than a small town, it's a classic salt dome oil field about 25 miles west of Thermopolis. And my dad was a pumper.
Phil loved baseball. He'd study the box scores in the Casper Star Tribune and imagine what must have happened on the field.
You know, if a player only had 2 at-bats, I figured, they must have pulled him or he had an injury or something.
But in his parents' basement, underneath the stairs, Phil found something that did even more to ignite his imagination.
There's a pair of cleats and some old flat baseball gloves, but there's also this jersey. And the jersey said, House of David. Every time we had a softball game, I would drag out that jersey and I'd wear it proudly. It was green in color and it had maybe 2-inch block white letters. There was no numbers on the back. Heavyweight cotton with half sleeves fit me perfectly to my wrists when I was 8 or 9 years old.
It wasn't the soft fabric or those big white letters that made the jersey special. It was the story Phil's dad would tell about the one and only game he played for the House of David, the day he caught for Satchel Paige. Yes, that Satchel Paige. Paige spent most of his career in the Negro Leagues, not signing his rookie MLB contract until the age of 42. He kept his own records and made the extraordinary claim that he pitched 100 no-hitters over his career. On the other hand, Phil's dad, George, was an amateur who played for a town team. George Lease died when Phil was just 17, and Phil never got the chance to ask his dad for details, like when or where the game was played, or why George subbed in for Paige's regular catcher, Cy Perkins.
He had a little spare on details, to be sure, but he did always point out the fact that Satchel Paige threw with incredible velocity and that his hand had puffed up. You know, it had swollen about an inch thicker than its normal size.
George also told his sons about his teammates from the House of David. They had long, bushy beards and hair that went down past their shoulder blades.
But there was never any more details until much, much later, 2009 to be exact.
But before we get to that, we need to meet another young boy in another small town. Chris Siriano grew up in Benton Harbor, Michigan. And when he was young, his parents took him to a place called the House of David Amusement Park.
It was such a cool experience to go there on a Sunday after church and walk up to the big train depot where you got an ice cream cone and probably on a waffle cone, which they invented. You had to board the train to get back into the amusement park, which is about a half a mile in.
Did you have any idea that there was this strange religion attached to all of this?
I had no clue.
After Chris came home from college with a degree in history, he thought it might be fun to tackle a local research project. That's when he first learned about the people behind that amusement park.
The House of David was formed by Benjamin and Mary Purnell. They were from Kentucky, Paducah, Kentucky, and they traveled the Midwest as itinerant preachers in the 1890s in a covered wagon. He taught that he was the brother to Christ and the Son of God and the Messiah.
When Benjamin and Mary arrived in Benton Harbor in the fall of 1902, they met up with two wealthy businessmen named Louis and Albert Bosch. And as it turned out, the Bosch brothers were searching for the Messiah.
So they agreed to join his cause. They've donated over $400,000 in cash, which is millions, probably tens of millions today.
Benjamin preached that his presence signaled the end of days, but he said his followers would never die. They'd live in paradise on earth.
In exchange for that promise, you give them everything you own.
Soon, thousands of new followers started arriving from all over the world. They'd turn over their belongings, and Benjamin Purnell would create for them the perfect new job. And that's how he ended up starting a baseball team.
I think he just decided that there was a whole lot of teenage boys and guys in their early 20s with a whole lot of pent-up energy because they also lived a celibate society. They couldn't have sex. And so Benjamin thought that he should start a baseball team.
With very little to distract them from learning the game, the House of David baseball team, formed around 1914, got very good very quickly. In just a few years, they were being invited to play baseball all over North America. And this is where we get back to Phil Leese and the year 2009, because that's when Phil heard a radio interview about one of those invitations the House of David received. By then, Phil was living in Colorado.
Well, I was commuting home. At the time, I worked up in Broomfield, and I was driving on some pretty, you know, bad traffic back to South Denver. And listening to my local NPR affiliate.
You're tuned to Colorado Matters. I'm Ryan Warner.
And they had an interview with Larry Tye.
Tye is the author of Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. Larry, thank you for being with us.
Great to be with you.
I'd like you to
So,
set the
of course, the name Satchel Paige caught my interest, and I was listening attentively. And then Larry Tye began speaking of a tournament in Denver.
The Denver Post tournament had begun.
And in 1934, this was a watershed year for the tournament because it was the first time that Negro leagues were invited to play on a competitive basis, not just as an exhibition team.
Reached the first and the highest profile interracial face-off maybe ever in the world, in the baseball world.
The Negro leagues were represented by the Kansas City Monarchs, often remembered as Satchel Paige's team. But as Phil listened, he learned that Paige didn't pitch for the Monarchs in that tournament.
The idea that he was coming in with a team from this group called the House of David.
All of a sudden, then, for me, everything just sprang back into life because in a single sentence, I had Satchel Paige, House of David, and Denver. My father was a resident of Georgetown, Colorado, just up the hill.
Phil immediately went out and bought Larry Tye's book. He hoped it would lead him to more details about that game his father caught for Satchel Paige, maybe even the box score. But there's an even bigger mystery here. How did the greatest Negro League pitcher of all time end up on the mound for a religious cult from Michigan? Well, the short answer is that the House of David signed a lot of famous ball players to short-term contracts. Babe Ruth even played for them in a game or two. For the longer answer, we need to go back to Chris Siriano. Chris has spent the past 30 years researching the House of David, interviewing members and collecting artifacts. He runs his own museum, the House of David Baseball Museum. Chris says the team was good enough to play in the major leagues, but
part of their belief was that they could never shave or cut their hair. The major leagues wouldn't let them play Major League Baseball because you had to be clean shaven, so the Negro Leagues invited them to play with them because they couldn't play in the major leagues because they were black. So they teamed up together and they traveled the country in the late 1920s all the way through roughly 1940.
And the team that the House of David would most often travel with was the Kansas City Monarchs. There's this one story Chris loves to tell about those days. He heard it from Lloyd Dallagher, a House of David member who played from 1926 through 1940.
They would travel in two buses. He said when we only pulled into town with one bus.
The other bus, Lloyd said, would wait while Lloyd, his father, and another House of David player marched into the baseball manager's office and said,
Mr. Manager, we're so happy to be here in your town and we're excited and you're going to love us, but here's the deal, sir.
The men would explain that before they played their game that day, the Kansas City Monarchs were going to take the field.
Never before have you even allowed them into your stadium, much less your town. But sir, they're going to put on a show, and after that, we're going to play. And then after the games, they're going to come to the restaurant with us that we always go to, and we've booked rooms in the hotel that we always stay at. And if you can't make all that happen, sir, the next town past yours is on rain check. So it's fine if you can't make all this happen. We're just going to leave and keep going. The room would get silent. Sometimes these managers would throw things. They'd punch the wall or they'd scream at us or, you know, they'd leave the room and slam the door. And he said, we'd just stand there.
As Lloyd told Chris, every time the baseball manager would come back and say that the Monarchs would be allowed to play, but that the House of David should never expect to be invited back again.
But he said, guess what, Chris? When the Kansas City Monarchs took the field and started playing baseball, their fans were amazed, and they laughed and they cheered. And at the end of the game, there would be a huge standing ovation for how awesome these Monarchs were. And he said, guess what, Chris? Next year, they invited us both back.
So while it might seem strange that Satchel Paige was on the mound for the House of David when they beat the Kansas City Monarchs in the championship game of that 1934 Denver Post tournament, these two teams had a long history of working together to inspire baseball fans. But back to our other mystery. Phil Leese had spent 45 years wondering when and where his father might have caught for Satchel Paige. Could this tournament be the answer? Phil's research led him to the microfilm archives at his local library.
You know, I went through several spools of microfilm. Eventually, though, I found the actual edition of the paper that had the box score of the game that my dad caught.
What was it like to see his name there?
Oh, my gosh. I was just overjoyed. I took cell phone pictures of it. I printed out some blurry copy of it. I couldn't get over the fact that I'd actually found the object of a search that had started essentially in 1964.
Phil found evidence that suggests Cy Perkins was a last-minute scratch, but nothing else that would explain why his father played for the House of David that day. All he could find was a box score and a few lines of copy about the 17 strikeouts Paige threw that night. But remember, Phil has a lot of experience reading a box score and imagining a baseball game.
It would have been a nice warm evening in August. I saw that in the newspaper weather. It was being played at 8:30 at night at Merchants Park, which means they were under the lights. And I know that stadium lights were this harsh, glinting kind of a blue light. So I imagine what that must have been like. There were 6,000 people in the stands, and my dad would have clipped on the shin guards, chest protector, and pulled on the mask, and he was taking a few warm-up pitches for Satchel Paige. And I can just imagine how that would have popped in his glove and how it would have stung. Dad was 0-for-4 that night hitting. I'm sure his left hand was swollen so badly he probably felt he was swinging the bat with one hand.
Phil wrote down the story of Satchel Paige, the House of David, and the day George Leese played in a game of real historical significance. He bound it into a book and presented it to his family.
And I just wanted them to have a connection to their father, their grandfather, and to a time and a place in a baseball game that was a magical moment.
But while the number of people connected to George Leese's story grows with every new generation, the same can't be said of Benjamin Purnell's followers. Purnell forbade them from procreating and promised that they'd never die. When Chris Siriano met them, the last remaining House of David ballplayers were in their 80s and 90s.
They loved their lives. They laughed. I swear they laughed with like a belly laugh, like my grandkids do. And they died and died and died and died and died, and now they're all gone.
That story first aired in April of last year. The House of David Baseball Museum is newly updated and open again for tours. Masks are recommended.
F-
Fritz Pollard was the first black quarterback in pro football. Many of his opponents hated him because of the color of his skin. Did that bother him?
I'd look at him and grin. Didn't get mad and want to fight him. Just look at him and grin, and the next minute run 80 yards for a touchdown.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Comedian Nicole Byer has some thoughts on organized religion.
10% of your earnings going to the church is an insane thing to ask. Like, that's how much I pay my agent and my manager. Do you know what I'm saying? And they get me jobs.
The Gospel According to Nicole. Listen to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
I'm Karen Given. As we mentioned during last week's special episode on sports, racism, and the myth of meritocracy, which, by the way, is still available on our podcast feed and on our website, approximately 70% of current NFL players are African American. But it wasn't always that way. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
The story of Frederick Douglass Fritz Pollard spans generations.
My earliest memory of him was when he gave me this football and would take me around in the backyard and show me how to run pass patterns.
That's Fritz Pollard III. He's the grandson of Fritz Pollard.
The first time he knocked me down, I was sort of shocked that he hit me that hard. But then I realized that I wasn't hurt, so you just get up. And you just keep getting up.
That was a lesson Fritz Pollard the Elder was well qualified to teach. Fritz Pollard was born in Chicago in 1894, the seventh of eight children. His mother was Native American, his father an African American who boxed professionally during the Civil War. Pollard ran track and played baseball and football at Chicago's Lane Tech High School, where his athleticism was celebrated. In 1915, he enrolled at Brown University on a Rockefeller scholarship, and things changed.
His teammates basically really wouldn't talk to him or anything until they saw what he could do.
What Pollard could do was rack up yards, 60, 70, and 80 yards at a time. Once he got the ball, the tough 5'6" halfback flew downfield, his trademark baggy football pants flapping in the breeze.
Once they saw his talent, he won them over, and his personality also won them over. So from then on, they had his back no matter what.
That would be useful. As the only African American on the field, Pollard was the subject of verbal abuse and worse. In the college game of 1915, punching, kicking, and eye gouging at the bottom of the pig pile were routine. Pollard was often a target.
He learned how to protect himself by rolling over and kicking his feet like a cat if somebody tried to pile on and drag their feet on him to cut him.
His teammates also protected him.
They would all wear baggy uniforms so that way no one could tell in the game who he was. And sometimes they even darkened their faces with shoe polish so they couldn't tell who he was.
Is that true?
Yes.
During games?
During games. Back then, you know, in 1915 and 1916, that's unheard of.
But there was little Pollard's teammates could do to protect him from abusive fans.
They had death threats when they played certain schools in certain areas. And these were Ivy League schools that still were as racist as anywhere else. It went all through the country.
There were times when he had to be escorted onto the field by the police.
That's Dr. Stephen Towns, another of Fritz Pollard's grandsons.
The Yale fans used to sing Bye Bye Blackbird when he came on the field.
Brown earned an invitation to the 1916 Rose Bowl. The New Year's Day game against Washington State almost didn't happen. Pollard's grandsons know the story, which began at the team's hotel.
They wouldn't let my grandfather sign in. So they said, well, take us back to the train station because if you won't let him stay, we're going back. Brown was going back to Rhode Island if they weren't going to let my grandfather stay in the hotel.
The team then refused to stay, and the hotel worked it out.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning they let him stay.
Pollard had become the first black player in Rose Bowl history, and he would go on to break other barriers. After a stint in the Army at the end of World War I and 3 years coaching Lincoln University's football team, Fritz Pollard signed with the Akron Pros for the inaugural season of the American Professional Football Association, the forerunner of the NFL. He was one of a handful of black players in the league, and he flourished.
He rarely came out of the game. He played quarterback, he was running back, he did punt returns, kickoff returns. He even did the punts and the kicks, where they used to do the drop kick for the field goal. There wasn't a thing he didn't touch in the game.
Pollard's accomplishments notwithstanding, Aaron Dodson of ESPN's The Undefeated says not everyone welcomed him into the pros.
And there was a group of players who just didn't really like the fact that this black man was not only in the league, but he was also an elite player in the league.
Pollard spoke about that in a 1974 NFL Films interview.
I look at him and grin. Didn't get mad and want to fight him. Just look at him and grin, and the next minute run 80 yards for a touchdown.
He did that a lot. Before the Akron Pros' first game against the powerhouse Canton Bulldogs, he tried it out on a football legend.
Jim Thorpe walked up to him and said, "Do you know who I am?" And he goes, "Yes, I know who you are. I've heard about you." And he goes, "Well, I've heard about you too." And he called him the N-word. And my grandfather, not to miss a step, called him the N-word. And Thorpe just sort of stepped back and looked at him. He said he was going to kill my grandfather. He said, "Well, if you're ready to kill me, you can find me down there in your end zone." And the opening play, my grandfather took the kickoff all the way back for a touchdown. And he's waving for Jim Thorpe to come on. And after the game, Thorpe said, "He's the best back he's ever seen."
Pollard led his Akron team to an 8-0-3 season and the very first pro football title. According to Stephen Towns, after that, the star player of the Decatur Staleys let the football world know that he, too, disapproved of Pollard's presence.
George Halas said he'd never play a team with the N-word on it again.
George Halas was one of the NFL's founders and a future Hall of Famer. Despite Halas's hatred, or maybe because of it, Pollard was a major draw. Some fans showed up to see him run, others to see him get pummeled. Some credit Pollard and Jim Thorpe with saving the league, which struggled early on to compete with baseball, boxing, and horse racing. Because of his star power, Pollard was well paid. He made $1,500 a game by one estimate. That's about $20,000 these days. In 1921, Pollard became the NFL's first black head coach when he was named Akron's player coach. In 1923, he became the first black professional quarterback. But Stephen Towns says his grandfather didn't receive the respect he should have.
Unfortunately, he used to have to get dressed in his car. Can you imagine that? Your star player having to get dressed in his car and then come onto the field?
In some ways, it's hard to quantify just how good Fritz Pollard was as a player, because stats from the 1920s are unreliable and incomplete. Fritz Pollard's pro football playing career ended in 1926. The following year, there were no African Americans in pro football. Pollard had already begun a career as an entrepreneur. He had established the first black-owned investment firm in the U.S. in 1922. He would go on to be a newspaper mogul and talent agent for many black entertainers, including Lena Horne and Pollard's former Akron Pros teammate, Paul Robeson. Pollard flourished as a businessman, but in the early 30s, he noticed a disturbing development in the NFL. And it motivated him. Again, Aaron Dodson.
In 1933, the league sort of enacted this gentleman's agreement that barred African-American players from the league. And he took it upon himself to continue those opportunities for those black players who had proven, like himself, that they were able to play in the National Football League at the highest level.
Pollard's response was to barnstorm with a team that included Jackie Robinson's older brother, Mac, and Paul Robeson. They called themselves the Brown Bombers.
Named after Joe Louis.
Dr. Charles Ross is director of African-American Studies at the University of Mississippi.
They play out of Harlem. He was the coach of that team. And ultimately, he really wanted for them to showcase their talents and potentially apply pressure to NFL owners to have to answer as to why black players were not on these NFL rosters to say, hey, you know, we're pretty successful. We're very competitive against these white semi-pro teams. How come they aren't getting this opportunity to play in the National Football League?
Fritz Pollard III says they were more than competitive.
The Brown Bombers were 29-0, never lost a game. Their talent was just so incredible, it had to have been some kind of team.
Stephen Towns agrees.
They were beating some of the pro teams so badly that they had to hold the score down because they were afraid that they weren't going to play them anymore. So it was a little bit more than an exhibition game. When you got white players at that point in time playing black players, it meant something.
The Brown Bombers folded in 1938, one of the many casualties of the Great Depression. It's hard to know exactly how much pressure Pollard's barnstorming team put on the NFL, but the league finally reintegrated in 1946. Fritz Pollard faded out of the public eye in the decades following the demise of the Brown Bombers. Again, Aaron Dodson.
He really didn't talk about his legacy in terms of the league. He was a very reserved man, and once his football career was over, it was over.
Pollard focused on his family and his businesses. He watched from a distance as Jim Thorpe, George Preston Marshall, and George Halas, who had opposed the inclusion of black players in the pros, were inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame's inaugural class of 1963. But as time went on, Pollard's legend grew until some of the league's most powerful men took notice. One of them was NFL Commissioner Paul Tagliabue, who, according to Stephen Towns, would hand out books celebrating his grandfather's life.
Tagliabue told me that he kept a case of books, and he said he would pass those out to people who would come into his office because he was just so amazed at my grandfather's accomplishment.
Frederick Douglass Fritz Pollard died in 1986 at the age of 92. He was finally inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 2005, along with Dan Marino, Steve Young, and Benny Friedman. Stephen Towns was at the ceremony. So was Fritz Pollard III. He says his grandfather was too positive to allow the Hall's refusal to induct him in his lifetime to get him down. But that was no excuse for the delay.
He should have been in the founding class. There's no doubt about it. And most of the Hall of Famers say he should have been in the founding class.
Pollard's influence lives on, thanks in part to the efforts of the Fritz Pollard Alliance, which promotes equal NFL coaching and front office opportunities for minorities. Former NFL player and FPA chairman John Wooten says Pollard was the obvious choice to be that organization's inspiration.
All-American, first black to play in the Rose Bowl, outstanding coming from Brown. So when we started the organization, that's why we took the name that we took.
But Wooten's been fighting an uphill battle. At the time I spoke with him, there was controversy surrounding the Oakland Raiders' hiring of John Gruden to a 10-year head coaching deal without interviewing a single minority candidate, as per the NFL's Rooney Rule. And the league is still discussing ways to adjust that rule to make it more effective. Ross worries that the league and a younger generation of fans still don't appreciate Pollard's significance.
It's really a shame that he's someone that really remains kind of in the shadows. He's someone that really deserves a lot more exposure, a lot more recognition based upon the circumstances that he faced and what he was able to achieve.
Consider the progress that's been made in the three decades since the death of Fritz Pollard. He's now a Hall of Famer. A watchdog organization bears his name. Black quarterbacks are no longer considered novelties. Maybe in this sense, Fritz Pollard just keeps getting up.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach with a story that first aired in January of 2018. We'll have links to more about Fritz Pollard at onlyagame.org. Marcy Washington went to the University of Central Florida on a half-academic, half-athletic scholarship. Nobody quite knew what to make of her.
You were either a jock or you were a nerd. I said, well, I'm both. Hey, y'all can't make me pick.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
I'm Gregory Warner with NPR's Rough Translation. So there's a holiday in the Netherlands where every year thousands of white folks wear blackface. Some people are trying to end that tradition, but in a very Dutch way.
You talk until you reach consensus.
Can you fight racism in a way that brings the whole country with you? That's on NPR's Rough Translation.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, the possible murder of a 19th century Swiss hotelier and the mysterious origin of clay court tennis. But now I'm joined by Charlie Pierce with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
I knew there was death somewhere in clay court tennis. I didn't realize it was the origin story, though.
As of this moment, the Washington racial slurs, as you like to call the NFL team from D.C., have not announced a name change. But this week, elected officials told majority owner Dan Snyder that he would not be allowed to build a new stadium in D.C. as long as the name stood. FedEx, the sponsor of the team's current stadium, asked for a name change. And Nike appears to have removed all gear with a name from its website. Any chance all of this will convince Dan Snyder to do the right thing?
Well, I mean, they claim now that they were going to, quote unquote, review the nickname. I don't know what there is to review at this point anymore. And it isn't like this thing hasn't been a controversy for at least 25 years. I think the two signifying events, though, are the FedEx thing and Nike dropping the apparel.
Yeah.
Because those are folks with real power. If that's not the 2x4 to Dan Snyder's forehead to get him to do this, I don't know what else would be.
The NFL has told ESPN's The Undefeated that this song will be heard before every Week 1 game, should Week 1 actually happen. I'm gonna lift my voice and I'm gonna sing. That's Lift Every Voice and Sing, also known as the Black National Anthem. What do you make of this gesture?
This is another example of the NFL giving fed-up people stuff they didn't ask for. I mean, I have no problem with it. It's a lovely song, and it's incredibly important to a lot of people. But the people aren't marching in the streets to have this played before football games. People want the NFL to have a more diverse management structure, to have a more diverse coaching structure. You keep giving me gifts I don't want instead of the stuff I really need.
Staging the remainder of the NBA season inside the Disney World bubble is reportedly going to cost the league more than $150 million. Man, I knew those Dole Whips and Mickey ears were expensive, but I didn't know they were that expensive.
That's a lot of souvenirs. I have seen at the Orlando airport at the end of school vacation week, I've seen kids with $150 million worth of souvenirs, but certainly the NBA can afford the money. I mean, it's going to make it back. But it gives you a notion of how much the world has changed.
The 2020 minor league season has been canceled, Charlie. I knew this was coming, but a summer without the Albuquerque Isotopes, the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp, and the Toledo Mud Hens just doesn't feel like summer to me.
Worse, Karen, the inaugural season of the Rocket City Trash Pandas has been put off for a year.
Oh, no.
But I'm still wearing my T-shirt for all our friends down there in Huntsville. I still believe in the Rocket City Trash Pandas.
The league says that more than half of its teams are in danger of folding permanently if they don't get government assistance or an infusion of private money. What would be lost if that happened?
Oh, you know, dozens of happy small places. Minor league baseball is one of the few things about baseball that is actually as charming as baseball says it is.
Maya Moore has won 4 WNBA championships and an MVP, but last year she walked away from the league to focus on criminal justice reform. And now, thanks in part to her efforts, Jonathan Irons has been freed from prison after his 1998 conviction was overturned. What do you make of all this?
I think she's the sportswoman of the year, the sportswoman of the decade, maybe. This was a genuine sacrifice that has now produced genuine results, and there's nothing to do except applaud her.
Early reporting suggested that as many as 2 million strawberries would go to waste after Wimbledon was canceled for the first time since World War II. But now the All England Club has announced that it is donating some of those strawberries, 200 portions per day, to frontline NIH workers in London. Tasty solution, don't you think?
Well, yeah, it's better than plowing them back into the earth or something. I would like to know how much gin is going to be left unsold without a Wimbledon this year, because I think that would be also a big blow to the British economy.
Well, and the strawberries are usually eaten with cream, but apparently the NIH workers are not being given the cream.
Yeah, because the problem with cream is that it always rises to the top and all you get is executives eating it. So.
And finally, Charlie, the goalkeeper of Iceland's men's national football team happens to be a filmmaker, and that's why the video announcing the team's new logo sounds like this.
Bull, eagle, dragon, giant.
I kind of wish we had a filmmaker on our team, don't you?
This new Avengers movie looks great. Every casual soccer fan like me, for example, has been in love with Iceland ever since 5 or 6 years ago when the great Reykjavik Grapevine newspaper began its history of Iceland smiting people in international play. So, yes, I think this is a wonderful thing.
Dragons.
Bulls. Large, stable bulls.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
At Only a Game, we search far and wide for stories of athletes who've accomplished great things on or off the court. Reporter Olivia Christian didn't have to look far at all for someone who's done both, 59-year-old Marcietta Washington.
My grandmother asked me once, my sister could cook, she could do hair, she could sew, she could crochet, all these things with her hands. And so my grandmother asked me, you know, I know all the things Cherry can do. What can you do? I looked at her and said, play basketball.
I heard stories about my Auntie Marcy's basketball greatness growing up, her quick hands and natural talent. But it wasn't until recently that I realized that those stories weren't just family folklore. Auntie Marcy could legit play.
I was this basketball-playing, skirt-wearing kid at the park because my church didn't believe that girls should wear pants. So I didn't wear pants. But I was going to play basketball, so I would put a rubber band between between the skirt so I could play basketball, but I still had on a skirt. I grew up with a confidence that I really, Olivia, could pretty much do anything I wanted to do. If I wanted to do it. So I tried to do it all.
My Auntie Marcy grew up in the small towns of Marianna and Palatka, Florida. Her can-do attitude had her playing basketball against cousins, brothers, and friends in the neighborhood. And because those boys never let up against her, she was better prepared for high school ball than she even knew.
When the coach was calling out the starting lineup, we were all in the huddle, and she pointed at me. And I looked down at her finger, and it was at me. I'm like, I'm starting? So I knew a starter was a big deal, but I was just this kid, glad to be out there. And I had a uniform and running up and down. And so that freshman year, as I kept playing and I became the leading scorer, you know, I was up there with the seniors scoring with those girls. And I'm like, oh, okay, I can play. But my coach wouldn't let me do the street ball stuff. You know, street ball, you know, you talk trash. You know, you're doing one-on-one. You hope somebody would challenge you one-on-one. And so a couple of times, you know, I'm getting ready to run this girl down the court. I'm like, okay, you want to do this? Let's do this. And the coach would yell out, you better not pass the ball. You know? Yes. So, you know, you're on a team. So I had to learn how to play real team ball.
In addition to scoring, she also led the team in steals and rebounds. And one other category, the talking.
Yeah, my coach hated it. And so I didn't know how much he hated it until after one game, we're getting on the bus, he stops me. And I remember this so clearly. He says to me, somebody asked me, who's the coach, you or Marcy? And, you know, the little braggart that I was, I didn't say anything. I just kind of gave him a look like, well, yeah, who is?
My Auntie Marcy has another natural talent, one that would require her to be just as determined as she was on the court.
I was also fairly good at science. My mom was a chemistry teacher, so I think some of the technical things just kind of came. My dad was a brick mason. He was a master brick mason, and he could just do math and things in his head. He was a phenomenal man. I knew I liked math and science, but I didn't know what you could do with it other than be a teacher. And at our high school, they had this computer in the library. And it was like a you go in and put in all your interests, your loves, it would spit out some career choices that might be good for you. And so engineering was one of these things that was on there. And I'm like, what is an engineer? Because, of course, to me, an engineer was a train engineer. And there was, you know, a main train that ran through Palatka. And I'm pretty sure I don't want to do that for a living. So as I learned out about engineering, I'm like, oh, yeah, this sounds really interesting. So now I'm looking for engineering and basketball. So these are the two loves of my life.
As a senior in high school, Auntie Marcy led the state of Florida in scoring, averaging 27 points a game. But she wasn't recruited. With the help of a former coach, she went to the University of Central Florida on a half-academic and half-athletic scholarship. She enrolled in the School of Engineering. At orientation, professors warned parents that the coursework would be incredibly difficult, and half of the students would switch majors.
Well, that's a challenge. I mean, see, you gotta realize, when somebody says something like that to me, that's a challenge. Oh, okay. You don't think I could do this? You know, you were either a jock or you were a nerd. I said, well, I'm both. Hey, y'all can't make me pick. This is who I am, right?
That competitive nature served my Auntie Marcy and her new teammates well.
My freshman year, there were three other freshmen that were on the team, and they named us the Fearsome Foursome Freshmen because we were getting on the court and we were playing ball, man. We were doing some things, you know?
Auntie Marcy's 4 years at UCF were tough, but she didn't quit. She stayed with a heavy course load, writing papers and taking practice quizzes on the bus to games. She led her team in points and set records for steals and rebounds. But it wasn't until the year after she graduated and started working that she learned just how good her basketball career had been.
I believe the sports information director called me at home and said, hey, Marcy, we want to honor you because you scored over 1,000 points at UCF. I said, oh, I did? I'm like, okay.
She went back to campus for one of the women's basketball games, and she was honored at halftime.
I mean, it was literally just a basketball that, like, they took out of the rack, the orangest one they could find. They wrote the word UCF on it, and they wrote 1,000 with a black marker.
And just as she hadn't known what record she set on the court, she didn't know the significance of what she had achieved in the engineering department.
I did not know that until the week after graduation when I saw my picture in the paper, in the school paper, that I was the first African-American female. Nobody told me that nobody else had done it.
After graduation and over a Red Lobster dinner, my Auntie Marcy was recruited by NASA. Yeah, that NASA. Her first day was paperwork, but on her second day, she got a tour of the facility. She saw where they bring the shuttle off of the runway and all the people working on each and every intricate part.
And I'm walking under this thing and I'm looking at these people and they're just walking around like this is regular. And I'm thinking to myself, do y'all know where y'all are? I'm looking and it's like, oh my God.
Next on the tour was the vehicle assembly building.
And I'm passed by the wing of this orbiter and it's got the United States flag painted on the wing of the orbiter. And I promise you, and I still remember it to this day, that I wanted to stop and say the Pledge of Allegiance. I'm like, I'm proud to be an American. This is so great. Oh, I'm never leaving. Never. And I was in by day two, hook, line, and sinker.
Early on, as a junior engineer, she put in 14 to 16-hour days, 7 days a week, eager to learn from veterans on the team, eager to contribute, and energized by her passion for the work.
I kind of work basketball style in my job. And what I mean by that is, for me, basketball players we've got to switch gears very quickly, right? You're on offense, but if you throw a bad pass, you're on defense. Now, if you pout about throwing the ball away, so now not only have you thrown the ball away, but the girl has now gone down and scored on you. And so you've made two mistakes at once. So you've got to switch gears quickly. And so that's kind of how it was to me at NASA.
But on January 28th, 1986, about 3 years into her career, NASA's space shuttle, known as the Challenger, was scheduled to take off.
So what I remember about that day, it was wintertime, so it's cold. It was an unusually cold day for Florida. My offices were almost right behind where the press corps is. But on this particular day, because it's so cold, hardly anyone goes outside. I would just run out to the parking lot to see it and, you know, throw my coat on, run outside.
Like millions of kids in classrooms across the country, I was watching.
Challenger, go with throttle up.
Challenger, go with throttle up.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction.
As an 8-year-old, I didn't quite understand what happened. The teams at NASA didn't know right away either.
You got the contrails of the solid rocket boosters going off one way or the other. So I run back inside to say, what just happened? And everybody is sad. I mean, everybody is just, it was a very, very sad day. One of the guys who had been around, he said, well, folks, there goes the program.
The Challenger had exploded just 73 seconds after takeoff. All 7 people on board had died.
You know, people just started, they put their heads down and say, okay, what can we do next? And what can we change? You know, what went wrong? Let's fix that.
Auntie Marcy's team mentality, the one her high school basketball coach forced her to learn, came into play at a crucial time in her life and in the life of the space program. After the Challenger explosion, there were Senate hearings and investigations into what went wrong and how, if at all, the space program could move forward. When NASA wanted more of their most technically skilled people in Washington, D.C., my Auntie Marcy made the move.
No one person is going to get anything done at NASA by themselves. It is truly, because it's just too complex. So you have to work together as a team.
My Auntie Marcy worked for NASA for another 30 years.
I had a lot of pride in being able to say that I work for absolutely, it's the best agency in the best country in the world. What more can you ask for?
In 2015, a few years after becoming an ordained minister, my Auntie Marcy was diagnosed with bone marrow cancer. She spent months getting chemo, relearning how to walk, trying to build up her energy.
I talked to my pastor and I said to him, I said, well, apparently I may be as strong now as I'm ever going to be. So I told my pastor, hey, put me back in rotation. You know, different associate ministers get to preach. Don't leave me out because you think I can't handle it. Hey, I'll preach. When I get home, I can get into bed, right? I can't keep going like I used to, but I can do something, right? And so in the sermon, I talked about taking the devil on. You know, I said, when I realized the fight that I was going to be in, I said, I remember the 3-point stance in basketball, right? You get in a 3-point stance, you can dribble, you can pass, you can shoot. And then you're also in a position, same position to play defense. And so if I need to get out here and play defense and I got to fight this thing, we're going to fight it. Got to get off the bench, coach. Coach, you got to put me in. So, and I guess that's kind of what I told the pastor, right? He's the coach. Come on, pastor, put me back in.
That story came from reporter Olivia Christian. It first aired in July of last year. In April, we learned that Marcy Washington had tested positive for COVID-19. She's doing great now. She likes to joke that she's survived the 3 C's: cancer, cardiac arrest, and COVID-19. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.